chapter 9. Some leftovers. Judges chapter 9. Abimelech, the son of Jerubbabel. Who was Jerubbabel?
Gideon.
Thank you. Gideon went to Shechem, to his mother's relatives, and spoke to them, to the whole clan of the household of his mother's father, saying, "Speak now, in the hearing of the leaders of Shechem. What is better for you, that 70 men, all the sons of Jerubbabel, rule over you, or that one man rule over you? Also, remember that I am your bone and your flesh." And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf, in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem. And they were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, "He is our relative." They gave him 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal-berith. Understand, this is a god that this is referring to. So Abimelech, who is a Jew, is now a cohort of this foreign pagan god. If he wasn't already, now he's directly tied to him. With which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows, and they followed him. Then he went to his father's house in Ophrah and killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbabel, 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest of Jerubbabel, was left, the youngest son of Jerubbabel, for he had hid himself. All the men of Shechem and all Beth Milo assembled together, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar which is in Shechem. King of Shechem, verse 18 will say. So, we have this heinous act. One brother kills his other brothers. All but one. Verse 7, this guy, Jotham, the youngest, he finds out about it, and he goes and stands up on top of the hill of Gerizim, and he starts telling this parable, or this proverb, really, this proverb of the tree and the brambles, and you watched that last week. His whole point is, look, if you're being fair, then everything will be okay with you. But if you're not being fair, may there be a curse on you. Verse 8, 19. If you then have dealt in truth and integrity with Jerubbabel and his house this day, rejoice in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and consume the men of Shechem and Beth Milo, and let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from Beth Milo and consume Abimelech. Then Jonathan escaped and fled and went to Beer and remained there also because of Abimelech his brother. Now Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years. Then God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. And now we have the beginning of a little civil war right within even within the Shechem reign, if you will, but within Israel. So there's this civil war back and forth. There's battle back and forth. If you read it last week, then you remember that. Verse 46. When the leaders of the tower of Shechem heard of it, they entered the inner chamber of the temple of Elberith. It was told Abimelech that all the leaders of the tower of Shechem were gathered together. So Abimelech went up to Mount Zalmon, and he and all the people who were with him, Abimelech, took an axe in his hand and cut down a branch from the trees and lifted it and laid it on his shoulder. Then he said to the people who were with him, "What you have seen me do, hurry and do likewise." And all the people also cut down each one his branch and followed Abimelech and put them on the inner chamber and set the inner chamber on fire over those inside. So that all the men of the towers of Shechem also died, about 1,000 men and women. Then Abimelech went to Thebez and camped out at Thebez and captured it. But there was a strong tower in the center of the city. And all the men and women with all the leaders in the city fled there and shut themselves in. And they went up to the roof of the tower. So Abimelech came to the tower and fought against it and approached the entrance of the tower to burn it with fire. But a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head, crushing his skull. He called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me so that it will not be said of me, a woman slew him." So the young man pierced him through and he died. When the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, each departed to his home. Thus, God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father in killing his 70 brothers. Also, God returned the wickedness of the men of Shechem on their heads, and the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbabel, came upon them. If you didn't quite get the feel of it right here, this is the Wild West. That's what's happening here. What is the Wild West known for? Peace and security and tranquility and everybody's just okay and hunky-dory? No. What about the Dark Ages? If you say the Dark Ages, what do you think? Oh, I want to go there. I want to live in those days. the opposite of everything that we like to live in, right? This is what this is describing right here. This is one part of Israel is fighting with another part, and then they're fighting back, and one of them's killing 70 of his own brothers, and that's the ruler of the area, and he's ruling Israel. And who are these people?
God's people.
God's people, exactly. And these people are God's people. This is why we're not surprised when we come to Romans 2:24. Does anybody remember what that says off the top of their head? Romans 2:24. Remember, everybody needs the gospel, the Jews and the Gentiles. The Jews say, what, we need the gospel? And Paul says, yes, you do too, because everybody has sinned. But we have the law, they say. Verse 24, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Because of the very people who are supposed to be the acting, behaving the best out of all the world, they're the ones that end up giving God a bad name. This is what we start to see, if we haven't seen it already, in Judges chapter 9, right? Let's describe a scenario. What about a small church in a small village? Kind of sounds like us, doesn't it? Where the father takes halftime, you know, we have Sunday morning, 10 o'clock till 10:50 or so, and then we have a break. I call it halftime. He takes breaks at the Quickway. So this guy drives up the road to the convenience store here in Philadelphia, whatever the name of it is. Stewart's, thank you. And he takes a smoke break there. And the son of this man spends the evenings, these are Christians, who spends the evenings at the only bar in town, runs around with women, the church doesn't do anything about it, and all the villagers know all there is to know about this church. Does that sound like a healthy situation? This is real. This is a situation that I'm intimately aware of. May that never be. I'm not saying I said earlier that, boy, it sounds like us, doesn't it, right? I hope this doesn't sound like us. And to my knowledge, it doesn't. If this does sound like us, then what do we have to do? We've got to put a stop to it, right? Right away. Notice back in Judges, if you haven't turned there, or haven't turned out of it, Judges chapter 9. Thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done, and returned, in verse 57, all the wickedness of the men of Shechem on their heads. When they were out there murdering these 70 people and doing all that, what did they think? Did they think they were really going to get away with it in front of God? Who would think that? I don't know what they thought. But the question is, or the statement first, what comes around goes around, right? They were wicked, and it says God returned the wickedness on top of them. Did they think they were going to get away with it? I don't know, but do I? When I might not be murdering somebody, but I might be angry with them. So what's the answer for them? Exactly. Always the answer, repent. Here's a question for you. This might sound like an odd question at first, but if there is no God, then what's wrong with Abimelech murdering his 70 brothers? Nothing wrong with it, right?
No God, no rules.
It's just bad
public policy.
Right. But then the question, yeah, you'll run it into the ground. And then the question is running a country a good thing or not? Without God, there are no rules. Go ahead.
Where does all right and wrong come from? Even people that don't believe in God, you ask them that question. Where does right and wrong come from? Well, it's something that you're taught from your parents. Well, where they came from? Well, it's something that they were taught by their forefathers. Where they came from? You keep chasing that ball far enough, it all comes from God.
Right. Not society.
Right. Not the government.
Yeah, name it. You just name it. Name it. Name it. And I was just having this Bible study with a dude the other day, and I said, "Look, we can do this all day long. Just start. Name them. Name them. We'll just do this all day long." And he was quick. He got it. No, I'm not going to do that. He says, but he got the point. Miley Cyrus. Anybody know who that is? So, I hope that you don't know what she did, but it doesn't matter what she did specifically. The question is, what is wrong with Miley Cyrus and all the things that these people have done? All of them do, all the time. What's wrong with it if the Bible isn't true? And what is the media and everybody out there pushing? The Bible's not true. And so, when they in turn see what Miley Cyrus does and everybody else, and they say, what she did is despicable and disgusting, How can they say that? Because you can't have it what? Both ways. Exactly. You can't have it both ways. And in fact, like Gary is saying, their very assertions, every time somebody makes a value assertion, they are assuming the very thing they want to disprove. Oh, they hate it. They hate that there's a God. But if they say good, bad, right, wrong, true, they're assuming that there is a God. And the very argument itself falls apart. Because if there is no God, there is no right. If there is no right, then there is no God, either way you look at it. Sorry?
Survival of the fittest.
Right. Yeah. Let's go get ours.
But that's what's happening in Noah's day.
Yeah. That's what's happening here. I want mine, I'm gonna go get it. Give me 70 pieces of silver and I'll go get what's ours, right? Verse 6. Up through verse 6. Chapter 9 up through verse 6. So he goes to these people of Shechem. And they said, yes, be our king. And they pay him to go murder his brothers. And then they say, come here and be king. Are those people reasonable or unreasonable? Huh?
They're unreasonable.
They're unreasonable. I'm going to use that term for now. Do they adhere to some standard? An absolute universal standard? No. Their standard might be themselves or whatever it is. But they are unreasonable. I'll use that term for now. So are we surprised when in verse 26, these very same people start attacking the one that they were in cohorts with earlier? In verses 1 through 6, they say, come on, we'll be pals with you, but they're unreasonable. So when they turn on the one that they were pals with, are we surprised? Not at all. Get this into your minds. With people who are unreasonable, it is only a matter of time before they are unreasonable towards you. Just wait. That's took me a long time to realize that. Oh, I have hope. I have, and you do have hope, but that doesn't mean that we're wise as pigs or something. I don't know.
It sounds a little bit like the Middle East right now. Some areas of the Middle East.
Yeah, there's... Oh yeah, we can go through here and look at the politics of today. In fact, we'll see it more a little bit later on. Somebody, some leaders that I am aware of need to read this section right here. Because they'll see what rulers should do and what rulers shouldn't do. And here's one of them, like you say. People who are reasonable. So, this is, if for no other reason, it emphasizes the importance of everybody adhering to the standard. When everybody adheres to the standard, then you know it's going to be okay. But as soon as that one person steps away from the standard, be careful. Might be buddy-buddy right now, but at any time. Because the person who is unreasonable at one time, unless they repent, will be unreasonable with somebody else at the same time. The apple can fall far from the tree. Who? Abimelech. Whose son is he? Gideon. Now, Gideon wasn't a saint, but he's a lot better than Abimelech was. And I don't imagine that Gideon brought Abimelech up to be that way. I don't know. But here's Gideon. Whatever happened, here's Gideon and here's Abimelech. The apple can fall from far from the tree. We'll make more of a point of that later on. Here's another. If you don't have, if you have a comment or question, please raise your hands. Let's read something again. Judges 9. So there's the big fight. Everybody dies. 1,000 people burned. Abimelech dies. You remember, Abimelech burned the people in Shechem, right? And he attempted to burn the other people in Thebes, but it didn't work out. However, verse 56, thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father in killing his 70 brothers. Also, God returned all the wickedness of the men of Shechem on their heads, and the curse of Jotham, the son of Zerubbabel, came upon them. Okay, he just said, look, Abimelech got what was coming to him, Shechem got what was coming to them. And then he summarizes the whole thing by saying, and the curse of Jotham, the son of Zerubbabel, came upon them. Now look at what Jotham. Look what Jotham says. Verse 20 of chapter 9. If not, let fire come out from Abimelech and consume the men of Shechem. Did that happen? Was the curse fulfilled? Yes. And how was the curse fulfilled? I'll just answer what I'm looking for here. He said, let fire come out from Shechem and from Abimelech and consume the men of Shechem. Were the men of Shechem consumed by fire? So not only was the curse fulfilled, but how was it fulfilled? A literal fulfillment in this case. Actually, technically, only partially literal, because the fire did not come out from Abimelech, right? But we understand the point here. He said, fire is going to burn them. That's the language that he used. And what actually happened to them? Fire burned them, right? Verse 49. Now, let fire come out from the men of Shechem and Beth Milo and consume Abimelech. Was the curse fulfilled? Yes. How? Only figuratively, right? For Abimelech, the prophecy was literally fulfilled, but its fulfillment was not literal. Abimelech wasn't burned. Although he said, may fire come out and burn Abimelech. Was it fulfilled? Yes. But literally? Was it literally fulfilled? Yes. Was the fulfillment literal? You understand what I'm getting at here, what I'm doing here. Okay? It was fulfilled. But part of it was fulfilled exactly the way he said it would be, and the other part was just figurative language. Can you think of anywhere where this principle might apply?
The restoration of national Israel?
Yes, right? That's one. Sometimes what is spoken is fulfilled the way that the language is used. Sometimes it's not. How do you know?
Study.
Study of what?
Study the Bible.
The Bible. Let the inspired authors tell you. Let the inspired authors tell you. Otherwise, you're just guessing. You're reading somebody else's guess.
Let the scriptures tell what is fulfilled is fulfilled, and the rest of it is not really. We all know that what Jesus said, all is fulfilled.
Right.
All pertaining up to that point, right, knowing that happened.
Right. Good point. Gary?
And just what you say, don't speculate on what you're not sure of.
Right.
Be careful there.
Yeah, let the author, I mean, because this language is, hey, you know what, we might find out someday that there are some other unexpected twists that are going to happen. But we don't know it unless they happen or we're told by the inspired authors. Remember, it's the inspired author, otherwise we're just guessing, stabbing in the dark. Okay, so we go on, we leave Abimelech. And after Abimelech is Tola and Jer. Yes, sir.
I have a question really quickly about verse 57, before you get too far.
Okay.
It says in verse 58, God repaid the wickedness.
I don't have verse 58.
I'm sorry, verse 56. God repaid the wickedness. Verse 57, God returned the wickedness. And then in the very end, and the curse of Jotham came upon them. Do you get the impression at all that this is absolutely inspired commentary, or is it more of a, the audience needs to be reminded of this thing? Do you get the sense in this that it's indicating that because of Jotham's curse, it turned out this way? Or is it the author saying, and remember, I don't know, it just, they don't necessarily make a correlation between the two other than mentioning them both in the same verse. And I'm curious as to how that, okay, so if I was to speak a curse onto somebody else and something happens, am I allowed to make an observation too? You know.
We can answer the same thing we were just saying. Let the inspired author.
Okay.
The inspired author make the editorial comment.
Okay.
The inspired author's editorial comment was...
He says something, but he doesn't necessarily draw a conclusion about it either, does he?
What do you mean by a conclusion?
It doesn't say, the curse of Jotham, the son of Jeroboam, came up. I mean, it says that, but it's not saying that curse caused it. It's saying God caused it.
Okay.
God would have done it if Jotham hadn't said anything, right?
I don't know. I don't know if that's true or not, but we're getting into...
Speculation.
Yeah,
okay.
And we're getting into a philosophy of how God works with prophecy.
Okay.
Do the prophecies come true because they were said, or are they going to come true so the prophecy is said? What comes first, the chicken or the egg?
quite sure of it.
Right. Okay.
Well,
but
you
get. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Right. So here we have Atola and Jer. Notice how much is said of them. Yeah. It's somewhat sad that in these days it seems the less that is said, the better. I don't know. Sad, sad situation if that is true. Verse, it does say, Tola judged 23 years, and then Jer judged 22 years. It says a lot about their, it says a little bit about themselves and how much. And verse 6 says, then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So all I can surmise from Tola and Jer in that verse is that apparently Tola and Jer led them righteously. Because they were leading, and then they died, and then the sons of Israel again did wrong. So, not much said about Tola and Jer, but what is said seems to be good. I hope the same is said of me, if anything is said of me.
It's possible to learn more from negative lessons.
Say it again?
It's possible to learn more from negative things.
Native?
Negative.
Oh,
negative.
Sorry. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's why sometimes just cut out the good. All right, verse 6, Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served the Baals. How many? Multiple, right? We stop there. What is that? Baals, plural. What does that say about Israel? Bad. And very, very bad, right? Not just one. One is very bad. Baals, plural, is worse than very bad, right? And the Asheroth. And then the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of Ammon, the gods of the Philistines. Thus they forsook the Lord. These people, they don't care who it is. They don't discriminate, right? This is emphasizing their depravity and the degree of their sin, right? So no wonder when they cry out, verse 13... God says to them, you have forsaken me and served other gods. Therefore, I will no longer deliver you. Go, cry out to the gods to which you have chosen. Let them deliver you in your time of distress. No wonder, and a point from this, God's patience lasts only so long, doesn't it? That's what we live, you know, try to, they are going after all these gods, and God says, no longer. But then we know the rest of the story, don't we? Verse 16, they're crying out. In verse 16, he says, he could bear the misery of Israel no longer. God is faithful and merciful, isn't he? We just said his patience lasts only so long. Is that true? Yes. But what did they do in between? They repented, didn't they? They put away all their gods. They said, whatever seems good to you, please deliver us this day. So they put away all their foreign gods from among them, and they served the Lord. I have up here that God is faithful. Because what is the eternal promise to all people? All you have to do is repent. That's Isaiah 59. All you have to do is repent. He said that to them. They repented. So what does God have to do? He has to forgive them. Right? Does that mean he has to deliver them? Not necessarily. But in his mercy, he goes ahead and he delivers them. Who could bear the misery of Israel no longer? Look in verse 9. The sons of Ammon crossed the Jordan to fight also against Judah, Benjamin, and the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was greatly distressed. Verse 16, they're in misery. This after they had invited them into the land. Here's where you make another parallel with what's going on in the Middle East and everything right now, if we want to talk about that. What do? They're worshiping the gods of the sons of Ammon, the gods of all these gods. That's an invitation. Please come in, make yourself at home. And when they come in and make themselves at home, and they turn out to be in misery, what did they expect to happen to begin with? They shouldn't. They should have expected exactly that, right? Exactly what had happened. 1 Corinthians chapter 11. I'll tell you, I don't know exactly what this means. But I get the point. 1 Corinthians 11. Whoever eats the bread and drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner shall be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. But a man must examine himself, and so doing he is to eat the bread and drink the cup. For he who eats and drinks judgment to himself if he does not judge the body rightly. For this reason, many among you are weak and sick, And a number sleep, I don't know exactly what that means, but I know what it's tied to. They're sinning. And the next thing you know, a number of you are weak and sleeping and sick. Well, they should have known that already. Because guess what? When you sin, that's what happens. Sin has consequences. So when you sin, don't be surprised when the consequences come up and hit you in the head. Because that's what always happens. Comments or questions here? All right. So we get into Jephthah. Ammon surrounded and camped in Gilead. Jephthah, verse 11, is a Gileadite, a valiant warrior. He was the son of a harlot. And Gilead was the father of Jephthah. Gilead's wife bore him sons, and when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, "You are not to have an inheritance in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman." Was that nice? It wasn't a nice thing to do. Was it legal? Apparently it was. This helps us understand a passage in 2 Peter. I'll just read it. You can turn there if you want. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 16. "Act as free men and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bondslaves of God." So you have this freedom. It's legal to pick on this person. That's what's going on. They're picking on him, just like children would. They're picking on him. Is it legal? Yes, it is. But does that mean you should do it? No. But it's legal. Don't use that as an act or as a covering for your act of evil. That's what's going on here. Verse 6, right? First of all, they chase him out, and then what do? They come crawling on their hands and knees back to him, and they say, "Man, we never, ever should have done that to you to begin with." That's the lesson here. Not only is it a sin in front of God, but you don't know when you're going to need to come back to this person begging them for your forgiveness. So just avoid it to begin with. Everybody know what the expression "eating crow" means? Yeah. That's what he was doing, essentially. Eating crow, these people were doing.
But whoops. It was the sons that drove him out, right? The other sons of Gilead.
Yes.
The elders went to beg him back.
Well.
So, you know.
"Did you not hate me and drive me from my father's house?"
Yeah. Right. So it's they're all interconnected. Yeah. Okay. So Jephthah, they say, "Please, come and be our king." Verse 12, Jephthah sent messengers to the king of the sons of Ammon saying, "What's up, guys?" And in verse 13, they say, "You stole our land." And in verse 14, the rest of it, Jephthah gives them a little history lesson. It says, "No, we didn't steal your land." Number one, what did God tell them about Ammon and Moab? Don't touch their land. God had told them, don't touch it. So Jephthah knows, hey, God said that. We didn't do it. He knows his history, too. Some points to be made here. He ends up by saying to them, verse 23, "The Lord," there's his name, "Jehovah, the God of Israel, drove out the Amorites." Verse 24, "Do you not possess what Chemosh," excuse me, "your God gives to you, what your God gives you to possess? So whatever the Lord, Jehovah, our God has driven out before us, we will possess it." In other words, what is this a real fight over?
Who is God?
Who's God? You possess Chemosh's land, we possess Jehovah's land. Jehovah went in and beat up everybody else. Chemosh didn't beat anybody up. Bring him on is what they're about to say. And who's going to win the fight, Jehovah or Chemosh? Jehovah will. Gary, you want to say something?
You made that point.
Oh, sorry. Okay. So, he says, "Look, the Lord, he's the one that gave it to us." Verse 27, "Therefore I have not sinned against you, but you are doing me wrong by making war against me. May the Lord, the judge, judge today between the sons of Israel and the sons of Ammon." But the king of the sons of Ammon disregarded the message which Jephthah sent him. Now the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, so that he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, and he passed through Mizpah and Gilead and Mizpah and Gilead. And from Mizpah and Gilead, he went to the sons of Ammon. Jephthah made a vow to the Lord, said, "If you will indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return from peace in peace from the sons of Ammon. It shall be the Lord's, and I will offer up as a burnt offering. So Jephthah crossed over to the sons of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand, and he struck them with a very great slaughter from Aor to the entrance of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abel-Karim. So the sons of Ammon were subdued before the sons of Israel. Did you count how many times in your reading Jephthah said the word Lord? He says it more than most of the people in the book of Judges. Not all, but more than most. Verse 9. If you take me back, Jephthah said to the elders, if you take me back from the side to fight against the sons of Ammon, and the Lord gives them up to me. Then they said, yes, please. In verse 11, Jephthah spoke all the words of before the Lord at Mizpah. Verse 21, in his history recount, he says, the Lord, the God of Israel, gave Sihon. Verse 23, the Lord, the God of Israel, did all these things. Verse 24, whatever the Lord has given to us. And then in verse 27, again, the Lord, may he judge. In fact, in chapter 12, verse 6, when he's recounting this to the Ephraimites, verse 3, the Lord gave them into my hand. And he makes the vow, saying, I will vow to the Lord. Tell me something about his faith. This guy has faith. He is rattling off the word Lord like that. The Lord did it. The Lord did it. The Lord did it in the past. The Lord will do it in the future. The Lord, the judge of everybody, will do it. This man has faith. But what about his vow? So what do we have here? We have somebody with a lot of faith, or some faith. In fact, where does this guy end up in the New Testament? Where do we read of him? Hebrews 11. You need to have faith like Jephthah. All right, Jephthah has faith. But we're about to read. He made a mistake.
He wasn't perfect, but David made mistakes.
Right. The more I read the book of Hebrews, and Hebrews 11:32, and compared to the book of Judges, they say, I have more hope than I did earlier. Because, man, I'd be back there with these people doing what they're doing, these silly things. Let's read this just for a second. Maybe you have comments. Verse 34, when Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, behold, his daughter was coming out to meet him with tambourines and with dancing. She was his one and only child. Besides her, he had no son or daughter. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and said, alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, for you are among those who trouble me. For I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot take it back. And you know the rest of the story. I'll tell you right now, I don't know if he literally sacrificed her or not. I tend to lean towards he did. Shoot me if you'd like to. I just don't know. It doesn't matter if he did or not to get the point, or to get this at least. He had put himself in a situation where what? What could he not avoid? Either keeping the vow or murdering his own daughter, sacrificing something that's not authorized to be sacrificed. Or number three, Leviticus chapter 5 tells, if you get into a situation where you make a vow where you don't know for something good or for something bad and you don't know about it, then later on, when you finally figure it out, you go and you bring a sacrifice. Leviticus chapter 5, verse 5. He didn't do that. So there's either one of three ways this man sinned, if not all three ways. But he set himself up into a situation where no matter what he did, he would either break his vow or he'd sin. Or he'd murder. Either way, it was sin. And why did he do it to begin with? He made a mistake. He wasn't thinking, you know, whatever it was, right? I don't know exactly why, but be careful of what you vow, how you make your vows. That's really what it was. If he was more careful in how he made his vows, then he wouldn't have vowed whatever, or the word can mean whoever also. So he might have actually anticipated going home and sacrificing somebody. I just don't know. But he said, yeah, John.
It kind of reminds me of, is it Herod? Herodias is dancing?
Yeah.
I mean, he does the same sort of a rash thing here where, and I think in Herod's case, he's just kind of showing off.
Yeah.
How great I am, I'm going to offer half my kingdom. But I don't know if there's some of that here or whatever, just but
silly, whatever. Get back yourself up into a corner. Sound familiar? Yeah. Cross the red line. A great story of God's deliverance is overshadowed by man's mistake, but isn't that always the case? Isn't that, I mean, that's our daily case right there. God saved us, but look at this dumb thing I've done now. Look, I did it again. I've done it again. I've done something else again. He sinned. We've already gone over that. Did his foolishness outweigh his faith? He's in there in Hebrews 11. So what's the lesson or what's the observation? If that's, wow. I can't, I mean, I don't know what happened there. I don't know when it ended up happening. If he actually stoned probably his daughter and then burned her as a guilt offering, then that's just incredible. And what hope we actually have. If it's only that he dedicated her to the temple of the service of the Lord and perpetual virginity, I have no idea, whatever it was, he made a huge mistake. Whatever happened, he at least made a huge mistake. And God says, well, I've forgiven him for that, apparently. Without stories like this, I'd be depressed, wouldn't most of us? Comment, George?
Would he have sinned by taking it back?
He made a vow that he could not keep.
Yeah, but anybody could make a vow to sin, and God would be happier if they did not do it.
But he, yes, but Leviticus chapter 5 is where this goes. They'd still have to bring a guilt offering. Turn to Leviticus 5.
It seems like he'd have to be awfully ignorant for his kid. I'm not arguing, I'm observing. Considering what we know about him, it seems like that'd be a weird point of dumbness to not take that route.
And that increases his,
I guess,
apparent foolishness. Yeah. And he might not have known. I don't know how much these people... He knows their history. He knows the history. I know that much.
He's got a good point. There's three possible sins. Your murder, keep the vow, or break the vow.
Yeah.
Break the vow, you keep the
vow. Right.
That's a good point.
Yeah, he should have taken the third way out, but he apparently does not. Because the story does not end like that at all. You know, they mourn her and it's a yearly commemoration, things like that. But yes, he would have been still guilty of having broken his vow, but it would be, in this case, the lesser of two evils, right? But Leviticus 5 says, if you make this, if you find out you made a foolish vow, you still have to bring a guilt offering. You don't go through the vow, you bring a guilt offering, which means you're still in sin, though. Okay. Yes?
Verse 39, it says, he did according to the vow which he had made.
Yeah.
Now, how atrocious this could be, if we say something to the Lord, I mean, we're going to do something. God lovely does give ways out through that foolishness, but that's how serious it is.
Right.
It is, God, I'm going to do this. You do it.
Yeah. Yeah, sin is, every time there's, I mean, the penalty for sin is a death. And that always tells us how, it doesn't matter what the sin is always a serious one. Okay, so after Jephthah, he gets in this little tiff with the Ephraimites. I think I'm skipping something here. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm in chapter 12. Yeah, so Ephraim comes up to him and says, hey, why didn't you call us? And he said, I did, and you didn't respond. And so they get into what? The civil war. What is this saying about Israel right now and their relationship or the respect for or their... Do they have a clue about Jehovah God? Well, yes, but they're not listening to him. Right. It's the Wild West. By the way, verse 6, there fell that time 42,000 people of Ephraim. And you know where we read of Ephraim again? Not that often. He'll be involved with Jeroboam. Jeroboam, who was the first king of the northern kingdom, was from Ephraim, which we need to add to why Ephraim. Why does it always say Ephraim? Because Jeroboam was from there also. But we don't hear much about Ephraim after this. Verse 7, Jephthah judged Israel 6 years. And then he died. Then there's Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon. And he rode, who they rode 70 donkeys, the children of Abdon. And he judged Israel 8 years. Okay. Verse 13. Chapter 13, verse 1, getting into tonight's text. Is there a question about the questions? It's running late, so we won't cover them. Sorry. Thank you for doing them. So, now the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. Stop there. Israel did what? Evil. And what modifies that? Again. So here's the question. I think I can do that and go right to it. What was Israel's problem or problems? Why? Why again and again and again? Ian?
It's adultery.
From God?
Yes.
Yes. They've rejected God. They've chased after other gods. Adultery. More?
Idolatry.
Idolatry.
Every man did what was right in his own eyes.
Me.
Yeah.
Even the good men don't appear to have been raising their children, too.
Yeah, the best, the cream of the crop are...
Right, yeah.
In the land of the blind, the one-eyed are king. We're dealing with the blind here. The blind and the one-eyed. The best we got is one-eyes here, right? Anybody else? Why? You know, what's leading to all this?
Well, they didn't obey God to begin with by getting rid of the people.
They didn't.
And God told them this was going to happen.
Right. What about John Bosworth complains again? Rhonda swears again. Isolde gossips again. Gary... angry and impatient again. George didn't like his wife again, love his wife. Marcy didn't assemble with the saints again. Tanya got drunk again. On and on and on. What's the difference? There isn't any difference, right? In fact, what do all these have in common?
Again.
Right, again, again. And we do it. We do it. I don't know what it is. Maybe I hit yours spot on. I suspect not with some of you. I don't have any suspicions with the rest of you. Suspicions. But again, is the idea. So you know, we're looking at the mirror. Israel sins again. Lee does it again. Again. Why? So whatever reasons we just put up there, ours fall into that somewhere. Maybe it's something else. Maybe it was all five of them that we listed. Something like that. But beware of that when you're reading. Okay. There was a certain man of Zorah, who of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah. And his wife was barren and had borne no children. And an angel appears to them, her, and says, you're going to have a child. But, verse 7, now you shall not drink wine or strong drink or eat any unclean thing, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death. Then Manoah entreated the Lord and said, O Lord, please let the man of God whom you have sent come to us again, that he may... teach us what to do for the boy who is to be born. Now, I hope that Scott isn't going to go. Well, I hope he does go here in a couple weeks. But if he does, then he'll hear it twice, right? Here's Parenting 101. By the way, when I say 101, what's Parenting 101? What's the idea up there? Parenting 101. Sorry? Parenting for Dummies. Yeah, this is your, what, entry-level college course? 101 on the door. English 101, whatever it is. Parenting 101. The plan and the prayer. First of all, verse 13:8 said, he said, he entreated the Lord, please let the man of God whom you have sent come to us again so that he may teach us what to do for the boy who is about to be born. That's it, in a nutshell. You're about to be a parent. We are parents. You're going to be parents. This is what you're doing. Right now, you're on your knees praying, Lord God, help us. The parents did not interpret the special treatment as any indication of their great... They had an angel of God comes and visits them, and they say, well, we must be pretty good at what we're thinking about doing, because otherwise, why would he have chosen us? That's not what they think at all. They say, we need help. He's picked us, whatever. In fact, the divine revelation might have increased their, wait a minute, this man has a special purpose, a special mission in life. We need help, right? In fact, they prayed for help and they had faith. Manoah said, when the man comes back to teach him, Manoah said in verse 12, when your words come to pass. What didn't he say?
Yeah.
If. He didn't say a lot. Well, show me, prove to me. He said, okay, here it is. And when the man says, these words are going to happen, when your words come to pass. He's not perfect, but he has faith. And that's what God can work with, right? We need people who are have faith and say, look, God, whatever he said is right. And by the way, God, you need to tell me what to do. This is the answer. Samson's work, Samson's parenting began before he was born. With the praying and also with the woman, he says to her, you will conceive, verse 7, you will conceive and give birth to a son, and now, right now, starting from this vision onward, you're going to start acting differently. This is before that baby has even been conceived.
Yes, before conception.
Right.
Yeah.
So when does parenting begin? If you're showing up to a fire, when by the way, if you think firefighting is difficult, try raising a child, right? Because your prayer is this soul. The idea is God has given you this soul to train it up to be loving and humble and a servant of God, a sincere-hearted, loving servant of God. That ain't easy. Look back at yourself and say, boy, was that easy. Oh, yeah, I just walked right into it. No. And now you have charge of somebody else. That is tough work. So you're on your knees beginning day one. The probability of all parenting. With his parents, who sound like pretty good parents to me, what did he end up doing?
Here they are, they're training this boy, training. What's he do? Let's go get daughter of the Canaanite.
Throws it all off.
What's the matter? I can't imagine their parents ever like, what have I done?
Right, yeah. You know, how much time did the parents spend in prayer right then? It's agonizing, saying, my son, what has happened, right?
And the angel never really tells them.
What's going to happen?
But he doesn't give them any more instructions than he gave her.
Yeah.
Because they clean, don't drink anything from the vine.
Because they already have enough. Yes, they gave him the specific Nazarite, but as far as training this person up to be godly, they'd had enough information, just like everybody else in Israel did at the time, the law. We've pointed that out. What's the expression? Train up the child in the way he should go. When he is old, he will not depart from it.
That's not an absolute.
That's a proverb. It's proverbial, right? It means that's the general rule. On and on it goes, right? The probability. Our influence only goes so far. So here's another point to be made from that. The outcome doesn't necessarily reflect back onto the parent. Oh man, Manoah, what did you do? I can't make that assertion here. I see, it looks like if they were consistent, then they had a bad egg, a rotten apple.
When Samson says, go get that daughter, he's like, what are you doing? You want to go get a daughter? What about the daughter that you're supposed to take of the Israelites?
Yeah, our family, or maybe even, if not in our family, then the whole tribe.
Right.
Yeah. What are they doing? Right, they had taught him. Their appeal is to his knowledge. You already know this, Samson. What are you doing? So they had done their job. So he goes on, verse 14, chapter 14, verse 1, and we'll finish chapter 14, then be done for the evening. Then Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines, and he came back and told his father and mother, I saw a woman on Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines, now therefore get her for me as a wife. And his father and mother said to her, is there no woman among the daughters of all your relatives or among all our people that you could go and take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? But Samson said to his father, get her, for she looks good to me. Ugh. Being men 101. Ladies, listen to this. Get her for me, she looks good to me. Do you know who that represents? Generally speaking, men. Okay? That's it. This is the way men are. Women are too, to some degree, but apparently it's different. Right? But this is the way we are. I hope this is helpful for you to know this. I don't know how. You figure that out. But I know this. With you knowing this, you can help us. You can help us in the way that you dress, the way that you carry yourself, the way you walk. Knowing this about us hopefully will help you help us. Right? Being a man 101. This is for the men. Men, this is not the way to do it. Get her, for she looks good to me. Ugh. Whenever there's more testosterone in this chapter than any other chapter I think of. Get her, for she looks good to me. And they get her because she looked good to him in what happened. Right? Samson's wife wept before him, said, "You only hate me. You do not love me. You have propounded a riddle to the sons of my people and have not told it to me." And he said to her, "Behold, I have not told it to my father or mother. Should I tell it to you?" However, she wept before him for 7 days and she won. And what happens the rest of it? The rest of it, just chaos and carnage everywhere because of who he chose to marry. Don't do it, right? Being married 101. Whoops. Well, yeah, that doesn't matter. Being married 101. By the way, his parents told him, didn't they? Now, at the end of the book of Samson, the end of the story of Samson, you looking back, you look at the story and ask yourself the question and answer it. Should Samson have listened to his parents? If your parents tell you, should you listen to your parents?
If your parents are godly.
If they're telling you this.
Yeah.
Right. No. Right, no, yeah, that's a good point. I'm assuming that your parents are telling you, don't go to the other woman because the law says. Because the idea is, the trend is down. You can't lie down with the dogs and not get the fleas. It won't happen, right? Being married 101. Did you have a problem with that statement we just read? I have not told it to my father and mother, it should be. Why should I tell it to you? Who is he talking to? She says, tell me. And he says, I haven't told my parents, why would I tell you? The implication is he would tell who before whom? He would tell his parents before he told his wife. Anybody got a problem with that?
He's not separated. He's not left and cleft.
Genesis 2. He hasn't left and cleft. That's exactly right. Genesis 2:24. For this reason, you'll leave your parents, and all of your secrets now go to your wife and your husband. And when you call up and say, Mommy and Daddy say, no, you are home, and they hang up the phone. Right?
You have a problem. You and your wife have a problem. Don't call somebody else.
Right.
You need to deal with before God.
Do you hear that, honey?
That's not an easy lesson to learn.
No.
You know, we've been married 25 years. Mm. You know, not 1 year, not 2 years.
I jest. My wife knows that. Yeah. She's the one that helped me understand that.
Yeah, that's right. Right. That's not an easy thing to learn.
Yeah.
And to do.
Right?
That's right. You're mad at this person. Now you got to
talk to him about it. You got to talk to them about it? Right. Okay. She pressed him so hard. What is this an illustration of?
Maggie.
Yes.
All funniness aside, the power that a woman has.
Yeah. Right. Nagging.
So women, be careful.
Right. Gary. Right. Yes, exactly. Exactly. This is power. This is power. The women have power. Be careful how you use it. Use it for good. Use it for good. Don't nag for good. Use it for good. Right?
The overall little thing in this, was it necessarily a bad thing to be told, for her to be told the riddle? It's the only part that she probably was doing wrong at that point was the nagging part. But we are to love our wives and to try to please them as much as we can with the Lord as well. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it wouldn't be wrong for him to tell that. But it would be wrong to...
It was wrong for her to tell it, to repeat it,
right,
to those people.
Why didn't she tell him? Why?
Yeah.
Instead.
Yeah. Yeah, and it seems like he knew all along, right? And here we go, testosterone 101, right? Okay, so give me the woman. She looks good to me. And then he goes and he kills a lion with his bare hands, rips it to pieces. That's fantastic, although that's not bad. And then they come up to, the Philistines come up to the wife and say, entice your husband so that he will tell us a riddle, or we will burn you and burn your father's house with fire. Ugh.
They're worse than the Israelites.
Yeah,
this is their own people. We're going to burn you with fire.
That's a nation without a God. That's any nation without a God. Look in the Middle East right now, what's happening in other places. Yeah, right? And then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he went and he killed 30 people. Now, I know that God inspired him there, but this whole chapter is full of carnage. Does God want that? Why is what ultimately is responsible for that then? Sin, yes. Ultimately, it's following one's own desires rather than God's, and that is the test, isn't it? That's why I underline testosterone, right? Okay. Go ahead.
At the beginning, it says verse 4, however, his father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord that he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines.
Thank you. Perfect segue to the next point. Go ahead.
Was it all? I mean, it was Samson's desire for that, but God was using that to his benefit.
Okay, but when we use this language, be careful of the word "but," because the word "but" makes it sound like God was using it. It was Samson's wrong, but God was using it. And when you use the word "but," it sounds like, but it was okay,
right?
It's not. God, that just shows you God's power, what He can do. We need to maintain a separation. Samson did wrong. God is able to use the wrong in it. George?
I was going to phrase it as, we can't look at it from a sense of, see, Samson had to do these things. You know, Judas had to betray him. It's
right.
A matter of, despite the fact that these things happened, God was still able to control the situation enough to result in the outcome that he wanted. You know, there was a thousand ways things could have gone correctly, and they didn't, and God still accomplished what he wanted out of that. And that.
In fact, he knew it, right?
Yeah.
He knew it would happen. Ian, I was reading out of the same book. Okay, last point that I'll make, maybe you have something else for tonight, but the last point I'll make is this. As John was just alluding to, verse 3, his father and mother said to him, is there no woman? And Samson said, get her for me, verse 4. However, his father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. Now, at that time, the Philistines were ruling over Israel. They knew. No, don't do this, Samson. Don't do this, Samson. Don't do this. And so they're saying, don't do it. But it's actually God is in control, and he's got something else going on here. So, being a servant. By the way, you remember that expression? Jesus says, you are my friends if you keep my commandments, do what I tell you, right? No longer do I call you slaves, for the slave does not know what the father is, what the master is doing. I don't call you slaves anymore, because slaves don't know what the master is doing. You know what the master is doing, so you're my friend. But if you don't know what the master is doing, then you're just a servant. Did they know what God was doing? So what were they? Just a servant. Okay, get that. His father and mother did not know, but what did they do? What did they do here? They did what was right.
They tried.
Well, they did do what was right.
Well, they actually did go get the girl for it.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah, there is involvement
there.
Yeah, good point. Up until then, they're trying. They're saying, look, no, don't do it. So they're trying to do, up until that point, they are doing what is right. They're doing what they know, right? They're doing what they know. Here's the deal. This is something specific God was doing. God had something specific, a specific plan that he was going through. His specific plan, we can't know unless he tells us, and he didn't tell them. And so what did they do in the meantime? They went with what they knew, which is the general, this is what you always avoid. This is what you always avoid, okay? His general plan we can always know and do. And that's what we always do. We read his New Testament, and no matter what it is, if the New Testament says it's a sin, we don't do it. No matter how appealing, no matter what we think, if the New Testament says it's a sin, we do not do it. If the New Testament says this might be the best way to do something, then that's the way we go about it. Because he gives us his general revelation, and we always know and do it. Here's one application for this. Has anybody ever heard, I do not vote because what if it's God actually putting in the bad person into office, and I vote for the good person, but God actually wanted the bad person in office, and he gets into office, and it ends up that I actually voted for the bad person, I'm voting against God. Have you ever heard that? I don't vote because I might end up voting against God. What did they do? They went with what they knew.
They did the best they could.
Right. Now, there is a little bit of a difference here. They had to tell him. The law says you cannot marry. Voting, you don't have to vote. But the argument that if I vote, I might be voting against God is not valid. Okay, you might not choose to vote. That's absolutely fine. That's your right not to vote. The Bible doesn't say you must vote. But the argument, if I vote, I might be working against God, doesn't fall apart because God's the principle with God is, what did you say? Say it again.
Each of us has to do the best that we can to influence for good.
Right.
Whatever position we are in, we have to do the best we can to influence for good, for God.
Right.
That's where we are.
Yeah.
Each of us in our little corner of the world, wherever.
Yeah. And do what you know, what the New Testament has said. Look, and there when Edom comes along, hold on just a second, Ian. When Babylon comes along and destroys, demolishes Jerusalem, was that God's will? Absolutely. But you know what God says to Obadiah and Edom? Edom in Obadiah? You stood by and watched when you should have helped Jerusalem. Wait a minute. But they should have said, but God, it was your plan. The idea is you go with what you know. Let God be God, and you try to influence your part of the world the best as you can. It has an application to everything, including, in this case, voting, if you're into that. Ian wants to say something.
Do you suppose that maybe
Sorry, say it again.
You suppose that Samson was a spoiled kid? But he certainly is behaving like that. Well, I want him so kid.
All I can say is chapter 13 makes his parents look really good.
You're
right, though. Spoiled children. Well, right. Generally speaking is... okay. Gary?
In the roll call of the faithful from the book of Judges, who's the hardest one to understand?
Samson. Yeah. I didn't process any of that.
The hardest one to understand.
Yeah. He's in...
He's there.
Yeah. I'm thankful.
I have a hard... I mean, God said he's there.
Yeah.
I have to learn why.
Right. We have to adjust. We have to calibrate. Good point.
The harlot is there.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, she, you know, I can see her.
I can see her easier than Samson.
Her occupation. I mean, yeah.
She repented.
Samson killed himself.
Yeah.
It's almost like God was setting him up to be a suicide bomber.
Careful.
Yeah, careful.
I have responded my shit.
Right. Okay. Who does what? John?